Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world. Today's Tuesday, November 12th, 2013. And the reason that we talk about this is because we live in a very toxic world. There are toxic chemicals all around us, and they're making a lot of people sick in a lot of different ways. But we don't have to get sick from them. We do need to clean them up. We do need to be choosing the right products so that we're not exposed to toxic chemicals. But there's a lot that we can do to make those right decisions and to protect ourselves. And there's a lot of people who are doing good work in the world in order to help us understand these things, to change regulations, to make good products. And those are my guests on this show, people who can help us make sense of this crazy toxic world and learn what it is that we can do to protect ourselves and others. Today, we're going to be talking about risk. Now, I didn't even think of associating the whole field of risk management with toxic chemicals until a few years ago when I was invited to give a seminar at a conference for insurance agents. And as a good public speaker, I thought, what could I possibly say to insurance agents that would make a connection for them between their interest and my subject? And as I started looking at it, of course, the whole field of risk management, because what insurance is about is determining what is the risk that that they're taking in insuring somebody against some harm that's going to come to them. And there actually is a whole methodology to figuring this out and a whole logic of how to think of this. And when I looked at that, I thought this absolutely applies to toxic chemical exposure. So much so that I included it at the time I was writing my book, Toxic Free, and I wrote a whole chapter about risk management. So today, toxicologist Stephen Gilbert, PhD, DABT, is going to be back with us. And he's been on before a couple times, so please go look up his other shows and listen to them as well as this one, because he knows so much about toxicology. And I'm having him on regularly to share all that with us. And today, we're going to just talk about this piece of risk management so that we can reduce the risk of having harm from toxic chemical exposures. Hi, Dr. Gilbert.
Hi, Deborah. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure to have you on the show. So where should we start with risk management? You say anything, I want to also say that you're the author, Dr. Gilbert is the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals. And you can go to his website, which is toxipedia.org, toxipedia.org, and get this book for free. And it's a very, very good introduction to toxicology, the whole field of toxicology, and you'll understand a lot more about what we need to be concerned about in making decisions as consumers if you take a look at this book, and it's free. So go to his website and get this free book. Okay, Dr. Gilbert, it's your turn.
There's actually a chapter on risk assessment, risk management in the book.
I have that right in front of me.
That's great. And each chapter comes with a PowerPoint presentation that you can download and sort of flip through if you'd rather do that.
I like reading it out of the PDF.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. So risk is really interesting because we manage risk all the time. I'll bet you drove into work today.
I work at home. I have no risk in walking from my bedroom or my kitchen into my office.
That's great. I work at home also most of the time. But risk is, I think about automobiles. We drive automobiles, a lot of risk in automobiles, and we use seatbelts to mitigate some of that risk. And that mitigation was actually enacted into law. So sometimes we do a very good job of managing risk. We get great benefits from wearing seatbelts, and it's just a little bit of a hassle. But we know about the risk. So the first thing about risk is you got to know what the endpoint is, what risk you're worried about.
Yes.
Then what kind of exposure you have. So you got to know what hazard you have, what the hazard is. Automobiles is pretty straightforward. It's injury or death. But with chemicals, it can be a wide range of potential hazards and complications. And then you manage the exposure to that.
Yes. That's a very good summary of what I understand risk management to be.
So it really fits in with the seven most important words of toxicology is dose response or exposure response. What's the dose that causes the response? In toxicology, we're usually dealing with adverse response. And then hazard times exposure equals risk. So is there a hazard? What is that hazard? How much exposure do we have? And that'll help us define the risk. And you really want to factor individual susceptibility into that. Like some people will be more susceptible than others, like children, for example, who eat more, breathe more, drink more than adults do. So therefore, they have a small amount of exposure translates into a much bigger dose, which increases their risk.
I totally agree. I think that one of the most difficult parts of this is determining what is the hazard and also the individual susceptibility part. I've been doing a lot of research on toxic chemicals lately, and there's not always agreement on how harmful something is. Or maybe I shouldn't say it's not that people aren't in agreement as to how harmful it is, but there sure is difficulty in sometimes getting people to understand that there is a harm, that you can look at a lot of studies, you can look at how you feel in your own body, and but there's a lot of toxic chemicals that are in products and easily available for exposure that shouldn't be. And they could be taken off the market, they could be banned, all those things, and they aren't yet being. And so there's that whole question of where is the hazard, which is one thing, like what is the inherent toxicology of something? And
yeah, you raise a really good point. And I think I carry just a little further than that, you know, sometimes the hazard, you know, industry or other interests create a lot of uncertainty around the potential hazard. Like the tobacco industry.
Yes, that's exactly what I was trying to say.
that's a real key part of this discussion. Because industry and tobacco is a great example of that, where tobacco industry for years created a lot of uncertainty about the potential health effects of tobacco. Clouding the issue, does cigarette smoking really cause lung cancer? It's clear it does, but they clouded that issue and did a lot of things to create a lot of uncertainty, so it delayed a lot of regulation around that. And that's been a problem in many different chemicals. One of the most recent ones is bisphenol A, which some of your listeners might be aware of, and many of us are exposed to bisphenol A and excreted in our urine. And were we ever given consent? Did we ever consent to be exposed to bisphenol A? No.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, and then we're just learning more about the low-level effects, the low-level endocrine disruptor effects of something like bisphenol A. So I think it's trying to understand the hazard, what the potential hazardous health effects are, but it's also trying to learn about exposure, where industry's not required to even disclose that some of these chemicals are in the products we're using.
Well,
example, great example of that.
Yeah, a lot of these chemicals aren't on the label. And so if we're trying to do a risk assessment and follow those guidelines that you offered earlier of knowing what is the hazard, knowing where the exposure is, factoring in your individual susceptibility, and then considering what you could do instead to reduce the risk, we don't even have the data a lot of times. And this is part of why I wanted to talk about this today, is because if we could look on a label and see, for example, that in a jar of applesauce, there's apples and there's pesticides, then we could say, well, I'm going to choose this one that has no pesticides over the one that has pesticides. But what we have in the world today is that the jar says apples, and then another one says organic apples, and they don't tell you that there's pesticides in the one that with the apples. They just tell you that this one other one over here is organic. And I really think that if there were a requirement, even if none of these chemicals got banned, if they were on the label, if every single product, especially the most toxic ones, were required.
Yeah, I really agree with you. I think we need more transparency and more disclosure of what chemicals are in the products. Washington State just voted, and California did the year before, on a proposition to label genetically modified foods. And it was defeated by industry pouring tens of millions of dollars into the ballot measure. But that's an example where I think we have a right to know. We have a right to know what's in our products, what's in our cosmetics, what's in our personal care products, what chemicals we are being exposed to. That's the first step in figuring out what the hazard might be and how to reduce exposure to these chemicals.
We need to take a break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and we'll be talking about how we can assess the risk of different toxic chemicals in our consumer products. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals. And you can get that book free on his website at toxipedia.org. That's T-O-X-I-P-E-D-I-A.org. Dr. Gilbert, let's talk about, give us a little, like, take us through risk assessment for something, a product or a chemical. Like, what are the steps that you would do?
That's a great question. And to lead off to that question, you know, risk assessment is a formal process where you gather data on exposure and response, and then you try to bring all the data together to come up with some potentially least harmful level of exposure to that chemical. But I want to read a quote from William Ruckelshaus, who was the first administrator of the U.S. EPA in 1984. And he said, "We should remember that risk assessment data can be like the captured spy. If you torture it long enough, it will tell you anything you want to know."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has been a real problem. We were just discussing the uncertainty that some people create around a chemical and the potential hazard, and that's a real problem. So it is that you take risk assessment data, but it is very malleable, and it's very tough to come to agreement on exactly what kind of exposure would be acceptable.
I think that there's that these decisions are being made at different levels. Like, the government is deciding, and they're not exactly objective because they're being influenced by a lot of factors, but the government is deciding what did they think are chemicals that, what is the risk factor for how much you can be exposed to a chemical in order to allow it in certain things? Like, there are regulations that say this amount of chemical can be allowed in our tap water because the government has decided that they think that that's the risk. Now, I personally don't think that I'm willing to take on that risk. And so I, for example, reduce my risk of exposure to those toxic chemicals in tap water by putting a water filter on my water so that I can drink water that has fewer or none of those chemicals that the government thinks that it's okay for me to risk being exposed to. Different governments around the world, incidentally, have different opinions about what is safe for their citizens to be exposed to. And in many countries, the regulations are much stiffer than they are here in the United States.
That's very true. And some countries, particularly Europe in particular, takes a more precautionary approach to looking at chemicals and the potential risk for chemicals. So that means that they're putting the burden of demonstrating safety on the proponents of an activity. And we do that, you know, when we put drugs out on the marketplace, the Food and Drug Administration requires that the pharmaceutical and biotech industry provide significant data to show efficacy, is the product doing what it's supposed to, and is it safe, or what's the potential hazards of that product. We don't have a similar process for industrial chemicals. We do some of that with pesticides, but our Chemical Policy Reform Act really needs to be moved forward. Because right now we're governed by TSCA, the Toxic Substance Control Act, passed in 1976, which is basically broken, and we're and consequently end up being exposed to a number of chemicals. The other thing I wanted to mention was that risk assessment deals with one chemical at a time, and we're not exposed to just one chemical at a time. Like, our drinking water have a range of chemicals in it.
And even you could look, we're not just exposed to drinking water, too, which has a range of chemicals in it. We're exposed to, how many products are we exposed to during the day? Hundreds. And each one of those has its own combination of chemicals. So by the time you put them all together, you know, a part of chemistry is that that scientists are looking at the reaction of one substance with another and what else does it make. We're not looking at that as consumers. Yeah. Nobody's looking at that as consumers. Nobody's saying that once you mix even two or three products, the chemicals that are in two or three products together, what is going to come up with that? And then when you put all the chemicals we're exposed to in our bodies, how are they interacting with each other? And so I've decided for myself after more than 30 years of study of this that this is way too big a risk to just be wandering around in the world being exposed to all the possible chemicals that are out there. And that I just decided that I'm going to do whatever I can to reduce the amount that I'm being exposed to, because by doing that, that reduces the risk of harm. And
I think that's very wise and a precautionary approach, because I think we do need to, much as possible, reduce our exposure to chemicals to mitigate the risk. And I think that as we learn more about some chemicals, we recognize the risk is greater. Lead is a great example of that. The more we studied lead, we recognized there's no safe level of lead exposure. And yet a few years ago, we had toy products coming in from overseas that had lead-based paint on them. And who plays with these toys but kids? So we're putting our most vulnerable and susceptible population at risk for very silly things like having a brighter color paint and not being aware of the manufacturing process in another country. So it's very important that we manage these risks. And we often have the information, the knowledge to do that. We just don't take the precautionary approach to manage these risks well.
Well, I think that this whole thing about risk management is actually a skill that everybody needs to learn. I didn't know until I went to speak at this insurance conference that risk management even existed as a field, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about it today, just to make more people aware that there is a tool for assessing risk so that you can make wise decisions about what your exposure is to toxic chemicals. And I know we have a break in just a few seconds, so let's talk about more about that after we have the break. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and today we're talking about risk management with my guest, Dr. Stephen Gilbert, and he's the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, The Health Effects of Common Chemicals, and you can get a copy of that for free at his website, toxipedia.org. That's T-O-X-I-P-E-D-I-A, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is toxicologist Dr. Stephen Gilbert, and he is also the author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, and you can get that book for free on his website at toxipedia.org. I want to read just a little paragraph from the risk management chapter of my book, Toxic Free. When I was trying to describe this, I had to figure out this whole thing about risk management, like how does it work, what's going on with it. And I came up with a little example. Here in Florida, where I live, we have alligators in the water. This is definitely a hazard, because if you go in the water with alligators, there is a high probability that alligators will attack your body. But here's the important thing to grasp. An alligator in the water is not a risk until you put your body in the water. Likewise, a toxic chemical is not a risk until you put your body next to it, or put it next to, or on, or in your body. So we could be living in this whole toxic world, but it's really not affecting you until it comes near your body, or you put your body near it. The number one thing in treating poisoning, the first thing that you do is you take the person away from the poison. And so this is what we need to be looking at, is how we determine what's a poison and then where is it and how can we stay away from it. Those are, I think, are the two biggest key questions that we need to be able to answer, and there's difficulties in answering both of them.
You got to know there's an alligator in the water.
You have to know there's an alligator in the water, and then you need to know where is the alligator. Where's the water with the alligators?
And is there another route around it? And I think that's with toxic chemicals. We often don't know that the toxic chemical is there. We're not given sufficient information to know that that's a potential hazard.
Yeah. I think that this is the number one thing I think that we need to be fixing in the world, because it's not that it's not that there's no field of toxicology. Certainly, you've been working in the field of toxicology for all these years. I'm not a toxicologist, but I've studied a lot of it for more than 30 years as a consumer advocate. And so we know what, we know that there's dangers. We know how to assess risk and stuff. But what we're missing is just that data about how products can affect us, and where are those toxic chemicals in our daily lives. Dr. Gilbert, could you tell us, I'm looking at your book, and there's this really good part starting on page 258 where you just give more details about each of the steps risk assessment, hazard identification, and those. Could you just start with hazard identification? I know we've been talking a lot about that, but I think that most people listening don't have any idea what's going on behind the scenes in the world of toxicology to assess the hazard. Can you just explain part of that?
Yes. You know, toxicology, a lot of toxicology is driven by risk assessment, and hazard identification is a big part of that. So one of the first steps of hazard identification is to look at structure-activity relationships. If it's a new compound or an old compound, does the compound look like another compound that we know something about? And then you look to see, do we have data, human or animal data, that would help us determine if the agent has biological effects? You can also look for cell culture data and then do cell culture experiments to learn about mutagenicity and potential for carcinogenicity. And then you're trying to identify the hazard, but the trick with identifying the hazard is looking at what the endpoint might be. Is it a carcinogenic compound that's going to cause cancer? Is it going to affect the immune system? Is it going to have reproductive effects, alter reproductive function, or cause teratogenicity, which is a malformed infant? Is it going to have some organ specific? Is there ecological effects? Is it going to affect something in the wildlife? Is it a neurobehavioral effect? Is it going to affect central nervous system development? So you have to go through a range of these types of questions. And I think one of the big problems with risk assessment is we end up doing risk assessments with the data we have, not necessarily the data we want. And then when you're getting through all this hazard identification, the next step is characterizing the risks and looking at exposure in particular and doing dose response studies to look at, is there a low level effect? Or is it you're just seeing it at very high doses? So that's very important to narrow in, focus on which effect is most likely outcome that you want to study and really focus on and do additional studies to understand. Along with that, you want to understand susceptibility. Is there some population that's more susceptible? Are children more susceptible? Are the elderly more susceptible? Are women of childbearing age more susceptible? Is the developing fetus more susceptible? So you've got to ask important questions about that. And then the next thing is to try to bring all this data together and to help you understand the risk that you've got. And you can actually come up with specific numbers about that and try to establish through dose response curves specific numbers that might be a safe level of exposure.
Doesn't that sound really complicated?
Complicated. It can be very costly. But I think this is what we need to be done with. Particularly high-volume chemicals that we're exposed to a lot of, because an industry is not required to do or release a lot of this data. They have confidential business information, so a lot of this data does not come out. As I mentioned before, the EPA is responsible for many industrial-scale chemicals. They don't have the regulatory authority like the FDA does to require additional testing.
There should be one of the things that has struck me over the years is that there is no one standard for how all products are evaluated. That different groups of products, you know, pesticides are regulated by a different agency than cleaning products, for example, and personal care products are regulated by a different agency than drugs. And each one has a different standard by what needs to be revealed on the label, how things get labeled, and for example, in food products, you have to put on the label all the ingredients and in the order of how much is in it is first. And in cleaning products, which are much, much, much more toxic, you don't have to list all the ingredients at all. You just need to put a warning label on it. So it's really, really inconsistent. And even within something like particle board, which is emitting formaldehyde, which is a toxic chemical, if it's in a big sheet, it requires a warning label. If you cut it up and make furniture out of it, it doesn't. And so these are all really, really inconsistent. And if we just had one regulation that said every product, no matter what it is, needs to put down all its ingredients, I think the world would be a very different place. We would be able to assess much better instead of having all these things hidden away by all these regulations. We're going to talk more when we come back from the break with Dr. Stephen Gilbert. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio, and we're talking about risk assessment today. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Gilbert, toxicologist and author of A Small Dose of Toxicology, which you can get for free on his website at toxipedia.org, T-O-X-I-P-E-D-I-A. And that has a very good chapter in it about risk assessment. You can also read more about risk assessment in my book, Toxic Free. And you can just go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, and over in the right-hand column, scroll down a little bit and you'll see a picture of the book cover for Toxic Free. And it says underneath, start here, because it's a good place to start on this whole subject is to read my book. And Dr. Gilbert's books too. And so just click on Toxic Free. It'll take you to the page where you can order the book and read about risk assessment and everything else. Dr. Gilbert, I'd like to, since this is our last segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about managing risk by considering ways that we can reduce it. Number one would be something like just avoiding toxic chemicals altogether. But we can also, even reducing our exposure to toxic chemicals reduces our risk. And we can also share the risk with somebody else. And let's just give me your thoughts about how we can reduce our risk to toxic chemicals.
Well, I think the first thing is to learn a little bit more about the chemicals and what we're exposed to and what chemicals are in the products, and then try to find out less toxic chemical, less toxic products. There's some very good websites out there. You can look at cosmetics, for example. There's a website on cosmetics that's very good about trying to figure out what chemicals are used in cosmetics and trying to find out the least toxic, potentially toxic products. So I think that's a good place to start. And there's websites on toys. I think we really need to work to protect our children, have less toxic toys. You know, toys that the famous rubber ducky that has phthalates that keep it squishable. And so trying to reduce exposure to known hazards, you know, known potential chemical-laden products. Trying to buy more organic products is always a good idea, you know, in the food area. So it's really a matter of trying to control exposure. And you just have to constantly be looking at that. I think it's unfortunate we don't have a better system, a regulatory system, that makes that process a lot easier.
It would be a lot easier if our regulatory system did it for us so that I wouldn't have to do this. So
exactly.
I've actually, so I'll just mention on my website. On my website, you can go to Deborah's list. If you go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, go up near the top and there's a button that says shop. And it'll take you to, on my website, Deborah's list, where I've been looking for all those toxic-free products for all these years, all the toxic-free products that I could find. And even though I didn't understand risk management, I knew that if I could identify where the hazard was and then find something that didn't have that toxic chemical in it as a alternative, then that would be better. And so you can go there and you can find non-toxic cleaning products and organic clothing and just anything that you're looking for is probably there. And you can also go to my Q&A section on my website, because lots of people have been asking exactly these questions. Where can I find a toxic-free shampoo? Things like this. And a lot of my readers have been just pouring information into this Q&A blog for years, and there's a lot of resources there that will help you find the products that don't have these toxic chemicals. I want to say that for me, It's been a process of looking for, trying to understand where are the hazards, what are the toxic chemicals, just making lists of them and saying, I want to find products that don't contain this and this and this and this. And for everybody, I think that list is going to be different, that some people are willing to risk being exposed to some lesser toxic chemicals where I'm not willing to be. Like, for example, here's an example. If you look on a material safety data sheet, that only tells you the most toxic chemicals that are on a certain list that was determined to be the hazardous list. But there's other things, like, for example, food colors. I don't eat food colors. I tell people not to eat food colors. They're made from petroleum, from coal tar. But they won't show up on a material safety data sheet because they're not toxic enough for that list. And this is where we need to be making the decisions for ourselves.
Yeah, we really do. And I really encourage your listeners to talk to the legislative folks about the Toxic Substance Control Act and the Safe Products Act, that we need to have a better regulatory system that helps consumers. You know, and one of the key provisions of that was have a more precautionary approach, as well as more access to data about what's in our products, more transparency, because we really do have a right to know what we're putting on our skin, what we're ingesting, and what we're close to, and what we're being exposed to. And that's not being respected by industry right now.
No, it's not. And we didn't sign up for this experiment. And it is
no.
An experiment. And so it's like we don't even have a choice. And we need to have that choice and have this regulation. Dr. Gilbert, tell my listeners more about TSCA and what needs to be reformed.
So TSCA was passed in 1976, and the idea was it would help provide data about industrial chemicals that were going to be widely used. But the problem was that EPA has to clear these chemicals for use. Industry has to report to EPA that they're going to use a certain chemical, and there's a very short time frame for EPA to revise it. And to control those chemicals, there's like 80,000 chemicals now out that are potentially out there, many of them high volume production, about over 1,000 chemicals at 1 million pounds per year. And that, we don't know all we need to know about the potential hazards. So the bill really broke down over a court decision about asbestos. So the EPA lost a lot of its authority to really require industry to provide sufficient data to gauge the potential safety and hazards of a compound. So there's a big push over the last few years to try to amend that. It's going on in Europe, called the REACH program, Registration, Evaluation, Authorization of Chemicals. But Europe is actually quite a ways ahead of us in trying to provide more data on these chemicals. There's been some efforts at the state level, and so a lot of the states have been working on that. For example, Washington State banned lead, cadmium, and phthalates in baby toys. But that bill was taken to the federal level, and they preempted a lot of our rules and regulations around that. So there, we need national regulation that really provides a more precautionary approach that requires industry to demonstrate safety of the product and not have the burden of on the public to show hazard after the product's in commerce. And that's really where we are right now, where we being the public and the government, have to show that a product is hazardous before we regulate it. And it really should be in reverse, where industry has to demonstrate safety before the product is released.
Well, what does one demonstrate safety?
Well, good question. So we have a lot of experience with doing that. We know how to do that through, particularly to the FDA. There's a wide range of very carefully codified tests, toxicology tests, and there's a thing called good laboratory practice, rules and regulations about require very strict protocols for doing the studies and careful data evaluation and review of the information, so it's all above board. And so we know how to do this. We just don't do it. And there's a lot of, like you mentioned before, there's a lot of contradictory rules and regulations about this. And I also want to mention we have a thing called a safety factor, that when we find a level of exposure that we think is safe, that number is usually divided by, say, 10. So there is some effort to make things safe, but we really don't follow through with that in a lot of situations because we don't know the endpoint that we really need to be looking at. Endocrine disruptors is a great example of that, where we found that at low levels of exposure, there's hazards there that we didn't expect. So we really need to be very vigilant and really do more studies to understand this potential hazards of the product and, this, and the chemicals that are used in the product.
I totally agree with you. And at the same time, I'm just kind of looking at the decisions that I've made over the years for myself. And again, I'll just say I'm not a toxicologist. I'm not even a chemist. I'm not a scientist. I'm a musician. So I stopped being a musician in order to write about this because I saw that toxic chemicals were making me sick. They were in my house and nobody was talking about it. And I thought, well, you know, they made me pretty sick. It took me a lot to recover from that, but I did. And I didn't want other people to be sick. And my logic has always been to find whatever data I could find and then make a decision to find a product that doesn't have those things in it. So like with food, for example, it's pretty easy to see there's pesticides, there's food colorings, there's artificial flavors, there's preservatives, there's nitrates, all of those things, and even refined ingredients, sugar, white flour, all those things, they all have known health effects. And so then on the other end of the spectrum, I can just say, well, let's go to organic food. Let's eat whole foods that aren't coming in plastic packaging that is leaching plastic into the food. Why can't the government look at it this way? It's so simple. It looks so simple to me.
It does seem so simple, doesn't it? There's a lot of controversy about that, and a lot of people make a lot of money off these products. You know, and we subsidize a lot of the farm bills. It gets caught up in the farm bills and all kinds of policy that has really promoted cheap food that's not always healthy food.
Yeah. We're actually coming up to the end of the show, so I need to say thank you for being here. And we'll have you back again because you
thank
have
you,
so
Deborah.
Much
really admire the
great
work
information. Thank you very much. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio.